Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series.
You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Watch Hacks, streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Look out, it's only films to be buried with
the resurrection.
Hello, and welcome to Films to be Buried with the Resurrection. My name is Brett Goldstein. I'm a comedian, an actor, a writer, a director, a tambourine man, and I love film. As Ralph Waldo Emerson once said, "Don't be pushed by your problems, be led by your dreams." If you want to make a film about a love affair between a stand-up and an opera singer who have a singing puppet baby, you very much should. Sparks did, and it was fucking brilliant. Yeah, I love that film. That's fair enough, Ralph Waldo. Good point, well brought up. Every week, I invite a special guest over, I tell them they've died, then I get them to discuss their life through the films that meant the most to them. But not this week! This week, I use my newly acquired shamanic powers to bring back a former guest from the dead and ask them 12 new questions. And this week it is the return of the wonderful podcaster, writer, critic, presenter and documentary filmmaker, Mr. Mark Kermode. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein, where you get an extra 20 minutes with Mark, where we talk plain film secrets and many more wonderful things. Plus, you get all of the episodes uncut, ad-free, and most of them as a video. Check it out over at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein. Tickets are selling fast for the big, huge, live Films to be Buried with live at the Hackney Empire on July 2nd. Make sure you get your tickets for that from plosive.co.uk and hackneyempire.co.uk. So I said we were going to take a break, but here is the last episode before I'm going to take a break from the podcast, probably just a month off. Who knows? Don't panic. It'll be fine. We'll all be together at the live show on July 2nd. But this is a very special episode that I recorded with Mark Kermode last week, and I thought, I can't hold this off. You guys need it. He's brilliant. You all know who Mark Kermode is. You should listen to his new podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Take, which is a brand new podcast, which is exactly the same as their whole podcast, and it's brilliant, and you'll love it. This was such a lovely time. I really enjoyed talking to Mark again. I was very grateful for his time, and I think you're really going to love it. So that is it for now. I very much hope you enjoy episode 201 of Films to be Buried with
The Resurrection. Hello, and welcome to Films to be Buried with The Resurrection. It is I, Brett Goldstein, and I'm joined today by a writer, an actor, a movie star, a podcaster, a double podcaster, a triple podcaster, a non-fictionalist, a fictionalist, a lover, a cold swimmer, and a musician, and a skiffler, and a man. Please welcome back to the show. Can't believe he's come back. It's only him. Here he is. It's Mr. Mark Kermode.
Hello, Brett. What's the actor thing? I don't think I'm an actor. Am I? Have I acted?
Well, you're in films, aren't you? You're in Benjamin.
No, but I mean, as me, that doesn't count.
Yeah, but that takes some serious acting, as you know, from Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, that's right. Me and Simon Mayo were better at being me and Simon Mayo than Gordon Ramsay was at being Gordon Ramsay, which was remarkable. Although, weirdly enough, just yesterday, I was doing something yesterday in a studio, and I bumped into Simon Amstel, who I haven't seen in forever. And of course, you know, usually if you want to get in touch with him, you need to DM him on Twitter, because Simon doesn't do Twitter. He's got a Twitter account, but he only ever puts up very sort of, you know, short statements on it. And we talked about Benjamin, and he's doing another film now. So we talked about it, and I said, yeah, I was very pleased with it, because me and Simon did come out of it looking like me and Simon. Because I had worried that we were going to come out of it looking like Gordon Ramsay.
It is hard to play yourself. I have thought about that. Like, it should be easy, but you'd be so self-conscious if you're suddenly like, yeah, just do what you do. Suddenly you're questioning what your hands do, what your face does. I mean, no wonder Gordon Ramsay was a wreck.
I mean, yes, it is. It is really hard. I've done it more than once, though. Because yeah. I did it, at least I played a sort of, I played a version of myself, darling. I played a version of myself in the absolutely fabulous special. I was some arsey critic sitting on a sofa.
That's right.
Yeah. And I had a line that had a rude double entendre about first being attracted to her bouche, which I have to say, I didn't understand when I said the line. It was only when I saw it, and go, oh, that's sorry, I didn't get it. And then there was a thing, I always go back to this, because there was a thing on Extras.
Yes.
When Ricky Gervais was doing one of it was him being slagged off on Newsnight Review, and it was me and Mark Lawson Jermaine Greer. And then there was only a tiny little bit in the background, you know, slagging him off, only a tiny little bit. And then he did another one, like a sort of viral thing, in which he's on the sofa as well. And then we had to be ourselves for that as well. So I have a big career playing myself on screen. It's a stretch.
Big news for you. Congratulations on your new podcast, I love and is so different from the old podcast. It's a real...
Tell me about the key differences that really, really, really strike home.
It's a real bold new concept. Because I was worried. I was like, oh, man, they're really going for it. They're really mixing this up. And it is lovely to have you back. You've been gone. How long were you gone? A month? It felt long.
It was exactly a month, yeah. Yeah, it was a month. Enough. And, you know, and it was, I mean, actually, it was quite nice to just have a, you know, have a little bit of time out, because usually, mm-hmm. I mean, I know that we're off sometimes, but, you know, usually it's kind of one thing after the other. Obviously, Simon's got his show that he was doing on Greatest Hits. So, yeah, it was nice to have a break and then come back again. But, yeah.
What has stressed me out, because there is one difference, which is you're now also talking about TV. Mm-hmm. As someone who himself has a film podcast, I barely have time for the films.
I know.
Are you adding in TV to the mix? How are you doing that?
It's not okay. Just to be clear about this,
yeah,
we are doing some TV. We are doing. There's a whole thing on, you know, the second podcast we just recorded about Simon getting off his bike about the phrase film adjacent TV, because we were trying to explain we're not TV critics. We're just not. We will do some TV, and it was usually some TV that has a kind of a connection to what we know about through films, like for example Essex Serpent, which is directed by Clio Barnard. So consequently, you know, okay, fine. I mean, usually in the space of any show, we'd review, you know, 6-7 movies. We'll probably do 5 or 6 movies and a TV thing, you know. But it's not. We're absolutely not reviewing TV. You won't be getting the updates on what's happening in EastEnders. Or, you know.
I absolutely would love your updates on that, though.
You absolutely
would. And now
you've
said it out loud, you're going to get a lot of messages from people going, "Hang on a second, you threw that away quite casually. That would be fun."
It's funny because when I was young, when I was in Manchester in the '80s. There is a point to this story, incidentally. I used to do my laundry on a Sunday afternoon in there was a laundrette in Whitworth Park, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And it was a laundrette, and then it had next to it, had a kind of a sitting room, you know, room that you could wait in, and it had a telly in it. Well, I didn't have a telly because I was in my kind of, you know, militantly, I'm not having a telly period. But it turned out that the EastEnders omnibus was on Sunday afternoon. I think it was between 2 and 3. And I realized after a while that I was deliberately doing my laundry between 2 and 3. And nice. My friend Phil's like, what, you know, what's the thing? You know, we've got a band. Why? And I go, no, I've got to do the laundry between 2 and 3. And that was, I think it was, that was what I think is the kind of heyday, because it must have been, you know, Ange and Dirty Dan. That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah, yeah. And all that stuff. And I used to kid myself that I just, you know, I'm doing the laundry, but I wasn't.
You were deliberately making your clothes dirty so you had an excuse to go back. I've poured stuff on myself. I've got to get back.
Yeah. I need another 10 minutes in the dryer.
Mark Kermode, I have brought you back to life because I like you. You have been resurrected. But what point in your life would you like to come back to? Now or sometime in the past? Is there a wrong you would like to right or a right to wrong? Let us know now, Mark Kermode, please.
It was really funny. While you were doing that Voice of God thing, you went all glitchy. So it was like the Matrix. It was like the Brett's voice. Yeah. So what, if I could come back at any time, would I come back to the present or to the past?
In your life.
Honestly, to the present. Yeah. Honestly, I'd come to right now. Not because everything's hunky-dory, because like any other time in your life, you know, the things that are going well and things that aren't going so well. But I've got this sounds like a really naff thing to say, but I've got a really lovely family. And the last year has really shown me just how lovely they are. And I think that one of the things that's kind of strange is that you can spend quite a lot of time just going about your business and not realizing how much, you know, love and affection you have around you. And then you look back and you go, I'd love to go back to that point. I'd love to go back to that point, you know, when everything. And actually, I'm in one of the rare moments in my life when, as I said, it's not everything's plain sailing. It isn't by any means. But just over the last year, it's been a bit of, you know, it's been a strange year. And one of the things that has been demonstrated to me is that the family, and I mean not just my wife and my kids, but also my family, extended family, have just all been really, really lovely, solid, decent people. And you know that thing about you only really know people when the shit hits the fan. I've just had very good reason recently to discover that I really like how, you know, what a great family I've got around me. So I'd be very happy to come back to this, because it's not just because they've been great now and they haven't been, it's because I'm noticing it now in a way that I probably haven't done before.
Mark Kermode, you're going to make me cry like Mark Kermode watching any film. That's really, I mean, that's the best answer I've ever had for that. I think that's beautiful. I'm really glad that you are in the present, appreciating the present. That is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also the thing that's the hardest to do, isn't it? Is, you know, when people say, live in the moment. Yeah, try. Yeah. Just, you know, just have a go. Really, really hard.
You're a Zen Buddhist, you are. I think I asked you this last time, but it still astonishes me. There are films that you watch again. Sometimes you'll talk about a film and you go, I went to see it again, and often that film was 3.5 hours and fucking
well,
slow.
Tell you,
and I think...
But no, but there's a kind of, well, if I'm writing a lead review for The Observer, okay, I would like to have seen it twice. Now, obviously, sometimes I can't, but if I can, I will. And the reason is that if you're going to write something, it feels kind of, you'll understand it. It feels like journal of record. When you write things, when you say things, they're in the ether and they're like that until somebody transcribes them. And then you go, excuse me, I didn't mean that. But when you write things, it's kind of, and particularly with The Observer, because it's The Observer, it sort of feels journal of record-y. And so I do like to watch something twice to check because often the first pass is to do with, you know, getting the feel of the film. And then the second pass is to do with understanding it.
Yeah.
And then quite often, if you've watched the film twice and got a lot out of it, it's quite easy to step back into it. You know, it just is. And also the films that I love, you know, like the Richard Gere Breathless and, you know, Doodle and the Blue Cat and all those stuff that I've talked about elsewhere. They're comfort blankets for me. And I love them and they never let me down. And so there's always time to do it. Even when there's no time to do anything at all, there is always time to just revisit. And of course, the great thing is, you know, you can dip in and out.
Yeah.
I was late doing something. I was in a glamorous travelodge the last two nights. And I was up late finishing work, and I had to be up early in the morning to do the thing. And I made the mistake of turning the television on, and they were showing the Poseidon Adventure.
Oh wow! You were.
I'll just watch 5 minutes. You know, the next thing you know,
this morning,
an hour's gone. Yeah, it is anyway. So.
Well, you have come back to now. Well done. The living want to talk to you about films and whatnot, mostly films. The first thing that they would like to know, and they have missed you, they're very excited that you come back, I mean, imagine if this was what happened with Jesus. He pops back and everyone, all anyone's going is, what was the last film you saw? Anyway, what was the last film you saw?
The last film I saw will have been the whatever I saw screened on Tuesday. Oh, so it must have been The Quiet Girl, the Irish movie, which is wonderful. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. You know, it was like a kind of little oasis of joy in the middle of a slightly strange week. And I knew my colleague Wendy Eyde had said, look, it's very good. And, you know, you'll like it because she knows I like selling CMR and that sort of thing. But I went, it was a screening. The screening was at the Curzon Soho. But it was down, you know, it was down in I think it was in screen three or wherever it was. And it was really odd because there was only about five people there because I imagine that other people had seen it already. And then in the middle of it, somebody came in who I think must have just come in off the street and came in, sat in one of the back rows and very, very loudly fell asleep and snored. But I don't think they didn't come in to watch the film. They just come in to get warm or something. And it's an indication of how good the film was that it bothered me not one jot that somebody was getting a nice warm kip while we were getting on with watching the film. You know, because usually I'd be insufferable. I'd be making noise, but, you know. No, I thought it was like, have you seen it?
No, I haven't. I literally just read about it today, and it's the first I'd heard of it. But
so
it's
good.
It's
so
lovely,
good.
Right? It's a lovely one.
It's touching and heartfelt and understated, and it's got this fantastic central performance by this young actor. I haven't seen him before, but she's great. And it's really well directed, and it's just, you know, you just go, yes, that's it. Make that film. That's a good. And I came out of it feeling really like, oh yeah, you know, if I have one of those a year, I'll be good. You know,
that's really nice.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great.
Oh well, then I'll definitely see that. Mark Hermode, who do you think should play you in the film of your life?
Well, you know the answer to this already.
I do know this answer. And your answer is Jason Isaacs.
Yeah. But it's a fantasy thing for me because, you know, I know I've talked about this at great length, but I'll never tire of it. When I was at school with Jason, Jason was the person who I wanted to be. And I was a teenager and I had a teenage crush on him in that way that you can become completely infatuated with somebody. It doesn't matter your gender or your, you know, sexual orientation. It's nothing to do with that. You can basically fall in love with somebody because they impress you so much. And of course, it's funny because Jason now says, look, your version of me is completely wrong. You thought I was cool and aloof, but I wasn't any of those things. Actually, I was an outsider. I'd come down from Liverpool. I didn't know anybody. Jason talks about changing his accent so he fitted in North London. And of course, he's a chameleon when it comes to accents.
Yeah.
But because we're the same age and yet he looks half my age, I said to him the other day, I said, Jason, can I ask you a question? Because I'm completely, you know, gone completely Nick Lowe, as you can see from this. I said, Jason, do you dye your hair? He said, of course not. They dye it for me. You know. I'd love to be played by Jason. It will never happen, though.
Well, here's the thing. He could play you, sure, and he'd do a very good job. He's a very good actor. But you've proved that you're very good at playing yourself, so I think it might have to be you.
I'll do it myself, yeah.
Yeah.
Jason could probably do you, actually. I'm just thinking that, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, this is funny because on this, I'm looking at you on this camera and you've got this very kind of action man look about you that you've got in the black and white. You know, action man with the same length beard and hair, you know, with the eagle eyes and the gripping hands that you're using now to use your coffee cup. And
the grippy hands.
But, Jason can play anyone, to be honest. Jason can play anyone.
He could. That is true. What is the most romantic film you've ever seen? And is it Near Dark?
Well, you know, in a way, you've committed the Simon Mayo sin of asking a question to which the answer is yes. I mean,
oh, no, sorry.
I mean, the thing is, you know, in absolute terms, I love Splash. You know, I've gone on about Splash a lot. I absolutely love Splash because it's just,
I love Splash.
You know, I loved it before Quentin Tarantino loved it. All right, you know, now it's, oh, yeah, everyone loves Splash. You go, yeah, well, I went to see Splash at the Withington Cine City when I was in Manchester. And I went to see it like, you know, two or three times in the same week. And people said, it's just it's a mermaid comedy. What?
Yeah.
What's the thing? But I loved Tom Hanks in that film. I just thought he was so great. And then, of course, I then saw, like, they re-released Bachelor Party and it was terrible, except for the bit when he does the thing with all the burners are currently occupied, which was funny. And then it's lovely that now all these years later, Tom Hanks has turned into the person that Simon and I regularly cite as the best interview in the world, because he does that thing about he makes you think that for the time that you're in the room with him, you are the only person that's in the room with him.
Yeah.
But Near Dark will always have the upper hand, because it was, you know, it was the first film that Linda and I saw together. I thought it was a date. She says it wasn't. But, you know, it's, you can't ever unhinge the thing that you, that, you know, the time that you saw something in. I mean, like, I remember the best breakup movie I ever saw was Hellraiser. I went to see Hellraiser, which I'd already seen, but I went to see Hellraiser at the end of a sticky relationship. And I just remember going to, you know, taking myself to the Salford Keys to see Hellraiser. Yeah. And it was just like blood and, you know, stuff and pins in the heads and, you know, and all that stuff. And it was just like, yeah, there we go. That's the money. That's what we want.
I'm over it. Good.
Yeah, I'm so over it. And but yeah, no, Near Dark will always be the thing for me, because we, you know, we saw it together, and I remember thinking, God, I bet she thinks I'm really cool that I've brought her to this grungy vampire movie. You know, I didn't take her to A Star Is Born or you know, or something like that. I took her to see a film because I respect her. You know, and I'm sure. What she was actually thinking is, this is an interesting film. Who's he? Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I really love that. This one is a real interesting question for you, particularly given what we've said. What is the best film you've ever seen that you never want to see again?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, there are things like there are endless documentaries about animal cruelty, which I think are brilliant, but I wouldn't want to see them again because. Mm-hmm. Because I just, you know, I just find it heartbreaking because I'm a, you know, bleeding heart liberal. I know loads of people whose lives were changed by seeing Cowspiracy, for example, but you wouldn't want to see it again.
Yeah.
I think The Act of Killing is an absolutely existential, soul-shaking experience, and I cannot imagine having an evening free and thinking, you know, I'll do that. I mean, I did watch Act of Killing twice because I watched it once and then I had to review it for The Observer. Not had to review, I wanted to review it for The Observer. Mm-hmm. And so I went back and watched it again, and I just found it utterly soul-shaking. I mean, genuinely soul-shaking. But I wouldn't want to watch it again. I don't need to. I mean, it's pretty much burned into my, you know, my brain. Come and See is another example, isn't it? The Klimov, you know, it's...
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, once is kind of fun. The thing I would cite is... There's a film called Martyrs, which is a horror movie. And I've said this before, it's the closest I've ever come to walking out of a film without walking out of the film.
Mm.
And by the time I got to the end, I was really glad I hadn't walked out, but I never wanted to see it again. And I always cite it as a kind of interesting case of it got so close to having gone too far for me. Mm. And then it didn't, and I'm glad I saw it through to closure, but I've only seen it once, and I wouldn't go back and watch it again.
Like, are you able to articulate the difference? I sometimes wonder if it's intent, but I've heard you talk about it, and I think I feel similarly, but less than you, as in you like gore and nasty stuff happening, and then occasionally I hear you talk about a film, and you'll be like, that is a horrible, it was like, and it's another horror, and it has blood and guts in it, but you sort of find it disgusting and abhorrent, and... Can you articulate if there is a common theme of why that? What's the difference between one that you really enjoy and one that you're like, this is bad news?
I mean, I'll have a go.
Yeah,
I had a kind of a rule for a while. This thing about, you know, that in my experience, certainly when I started out working in film criticism, I was a horror fan first and foremost. So when I first started trying to get interviews and you know, that kind of thing, it just turned out that the people I went to were horror filmmakers.
Yeah,
I went to Los Angeles in the late 1980s because I've been working a little bit for Time Out and New Musical Express freelancing, but I was just writing film reviews and I needed bigger things. I needed features. So I went to stay with my friend Tim Polcat in, he lived off of Hollywood. And I thought while I was there, I'll get some interviews. And I sent out a bunch of faxes, it would have been then, to people saying, look, I'm a freelancer from the UK. I write for these publications. I can't guarantee that the thing will end up in any of these publications. Would you give me half an hour of your time? The three people who gave me an hour of their time was Wes Craven, who made Last House on the Left, arguably one of the most terrifyingly unpleasant films ever made. Sam Raimi, who made The Evil Dead, which was on the, you know, the video nasty sort of hit list and was described, one of the BBFC examiners said that after watching it, they felt that they'd been physically assaulted. And Linda Blair, the star of The Exorcist, which is the movie that sent people running out of theatres and into churches. They were all lovely. They were really, really lovely, thoughtful, nice, funny, sweet. You would have trusted them with your life. And then later on, you know, Gunnar Hansen, who played Leatherface in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, lovely bloke. Just big, big bear of a guy, you know, who, you know, was the kind of person who would, you know, give you, lift you up over a wall if you needed, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And then simultaneously, I interviewed some other people who were, you know, the head of some big corporations who make some big family entertainment, and they were absolute assholes. Yeah. Like really, really. I did an on stage with one who just will remain nameless, but somebody who was pretty high up in a studio which had made, you know, some of the most saleable kids' entertainment in the world, and I thought he was a contemptible oaf. Just sneery, just like appeared to have no love of movies in him. Did not appear to love movies at all. And so the thing with gore cinema is, I like movies that provoke a reaction, that provoke a response, and that works for me. I like horror movies because they take me out of them. You know, in the moment, you know, you're alive in the moment. But I think that there's a thing about that movies have an attitude that can be adventurous. Or it's scary, but it can also have an attitude which can be mean-spirited. And I remember talking to Nigel Floyd once about Peter Jackson, whose work I like very much, but he made this film, Meet the Feebles. And I thought that Meet the Feebles was a really mean-spirited film. Mm. And it was interesting to discover that, of course, it was born out of a great conflict, that he had been trying to get another project off the ground and had been frustrated and ended up doing Meet the Feebles. And you can feel...
Yeah.
The anger in that film, which is very weird for Peter Jackson because he's not an angry filmmaker, but that film feels, you know, you know what I'm saying? I mean, it's there's something about that film.
I know exactly what you mean. It's really horrible. It's really,
it's really just nasty.
It's not made with love, is it? That's the difference.
And there, that's hitting the nail on the head. And if you compare that to, say...
Whereas Evil Dead is made with love.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the George Romero, Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead movies, those are made with absolute love. And then Argento, I think, would be the same thing. You know, Argento, if you talk about, you know, his move from giallo into horror and Suspiria, Profondo Rosso, all those things, these are films that are made by somebody who, the joy of making the film. You can feel it. You can feel it. And that's why... Partly, I think, why Darry used to get so offended about his movies being cut, because he loved them. He loved the films. And then he couldn't understand why somebody said, well, I love it, but I've got to cut this bit off it. Yeah. You know, David Cronenberg once said that having your film cut was like sending a child to school and it being sent back with one of its fingers cut off because they'd said, it was fine, but we didn't like that bit. So anyway, there you go.
For sure.
It's a very Cronenbergian image, but... So, yeah, I think is the film made with a sense of celebration and love and or adventurous? I mean, it's perfectly possible to make a nihilistic film, but without it being mean-spirited. Yeah. I think mean-spirited, you know, is the thing that I don't like.
That's it. You got it.
I sound so sanctimonious, don't I?
No, I completely agree. I do think it is, as silly as it may sound, it is, if you make anything with love, you can tell The Exorcist is made with love. It's fucking amazing. God, you can feel the...
Yeah.
I get why you love The Exorcist. And then, I don't have to name all the films not made with love, but you can feel it. You can tell. What is the best action film you've ever seen, Mark?
Well, I love Point Break.
Okay.
I mean, I just love Point Break. I mean, I know it's a kind of, it's, you know, it's immediately in Hot Fuzz territory, but, you know, you've never seen Bad Boys 2. You've never seen Point, you know, which one do you want to watch first? Have you ever shot a gun in the air while going, ah? But the point is, Point Break is one of those movies like Die Hard that you go into it. Your expectation is not what the film is. Okay. So, I mean, I knew that I liked Bigelow, but Point Break was like, wow, you know, this is a surfing movie and Keanu Reeves apparently just jumped out of a plane without a parachute. And the, you know, the chase sequence, you know, when they're doing the thing and then you see how they did it at the camera with the thing and the hoop on the end, which they were following. That film barrels at such a pace, it's absolutely breathtaking. And I also remember seeing Die Hard for the first time because people had said to me, Die Hard is really good. And I wasn't a Bruce Willis fan. I didn't know Moonlighting from a Hole in the Ground. And, you know, I'd heard that it was, Cowboys and Indians in the Towering Inferno. And then you go, it's so good.
It's so good.
It's so good. And, I mean, obviously, it's, you know, it's got great script and great performances, and Rickman is wonderful. And but just as an action movie, as a piece of action cinema, it's great. But I think Point Break has got the edge, because Point Break is a film which, you know, it's land, sea, and sky. It's like, how many terrains can you run? And it's like,
it's
all of them.
Surf and turf, yeah.
It is. It's the surf, and turf. The surf and turf with, you know, with a bird, you know, with a bird, you know. Yeah. Surf, turf, and a buff. Anyway, yeah.
Good answer. You can have it.
Hacks is back for season 3, and so is the official Hacks podcast. In each episode, Hacks creators Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky speak with cast and crew members to unpack the Emmy-winning comedy series. You'll hear Hannah Einbinder and Jean Smart speak to their on-screen dynamic, along with Hacks writer and actor Pat Regan, on how their improv experience helped them when shooting scenes and what it was like writing scripts for specific actors.
You'll also hear from crew members like the costume designers on what it was like creating the world that Deborah and Ava inhabit. Hear stories from the show's writer's room, on-set antics, and more. Watch Hacks streaming exclusively on Max, and listen to the official Hacks podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Of all the films that exist, if you had to, which film do you think you could have made and why?
Well, you know, to start with the proviso, as I've said to you before, Brett, I couldn't make a film.
With the caveat that I couldn't make a film because I couldn't make a film.
So in a way, it's an impossible question to answer, because all the films that I love, I couldn't have made. And all the films that I don't like, I couldn't have made either. Not because I would have done them better, because I would have done them worse. I have always said to people, look, if I criticize your film, please understand that it's coming from somebody who couldn't have made the film. You know, I couldn't have made Oversexed Rug Suckers from Mars. I mean, I really couldn't have made even that low level. But of all the films, do you mean which one would I like to have made?
I guess what the question is, and is what's the sort of film that you think represents, maybe it's another way of saying, like, what film do you relate to? Like, have you, I've seen a film occasionally where I've gone like, oh, fuck, I could have written that, as in I couldn't have written sensibility wise I like that's
well I think you exactly know I think in that of... yeah okay I think in that case the answer, again, I'm sorry to do the old hits, but I'm an old man and I'm not changing my mind about much anymore. Mm-hmm. I think Jeremy is the film that felt like, you know, because bear in mind, when I saw Jeremy, I was 12, I think, you know. Okay. I saw it on a double bill with Breakheart Pass, and it was a supporting film, and I didn't know anything about it, and then it broke my heart in 1,000 pieces. Mm. And then I never saw it again for 30 years. Wow. But I remembered every single thing about it. And I think that the reason is, it's that, have you ever seen that film Velvet Goldmine?
The Todd Haynes?
Yeah, Haynes film. Yeah. And there's a bit in it when I think it's Christian Bale. I mean Christian Bale, don't I? Batman, Christian Bale.
Yeah, it's Christian Bale or Ewan McGregor.
He's watching the television and he sees, well, in the conceit of the film, he basically sees Bowie or something like Bowie on the telly, and he jumps up and he goes, that's me. And right. He's some, you know, he's like a kid in, but he looks at it and he goes, that's me. And although it clearly isn't him, it's, you know, because he's in a front room watching a telly and this is some glam rocker on the telly. But when I saw Jeremy, it was like somebody had, you know, it's that's me. And of course it isn't me, but I don't live in New York. I don't go to Juilliard. You know, I was never in that. I was too, you know, I was young. Yeah. I was never in that position. I'd never been in love and had my heart broken, although I did feel like I was in love and had my heart broken by the film. And then decades later, when I became friends with Alan Jones, it turned out that Alan, I love Alan, he's great. And it turned out that he absolutely loved Jeremy in the same way. Now, Alan and I are very different people. Our lives are very different. Our histories are very different. Our ages are very different. You know, I mean, Alan was, you know, he was, I mean, Alan's always been this kind of, my joke about Alan is you know, if in any sort of thing, like in any film you ever see about punk rock, okay, if you move the camera slightly to the left, there's Alan. And in this new film, Wake Up Punk, he's actually in it. And of course, he's in Great Rock and Roll Swindle, and he was working at Sex with, you know, Westwood and McLaren, and he was friends with all that stuff. And then he's the star of the 10cc. He's the roller skating star of the 10cc music video, whatever many beats per minute it is. And he was the guy, you know, so we've had very different lives, but we both saw Jeremy and went, that's me. And it demonstrably isn't. And then years later, I interviewed Robbie Benson about it. Robbie Benson went on to, you know, be a famous performer, and he's the voice of Beast in Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I said, the thing about the film is that, you know, it's like falling in love. It's exactly like falling in love. And he said, well, of course, you know, me and Vince O'Connor, who was the co-star, we were falling in love actually in that film. What you see is, you know, is real. I said, you must have such warm memories of it. He said, no, it was quite horrible to make. And then he told me that it was these stories about just what a really, really difficult, like really properly unpleasant experience it was to make a film which is full of innocence and joy. And I kept thinking, please stop.
Yeah.
Please stop. I don't want to know. I don't want to know, fallings out with the directors and the cinematographer. Anyway, you know, but it goes to show, you know, I remember talking to Terry Gilliam once about Baron Munchausen. And of course, famously, Baron Munchausen had this incredibly painful birth. But when you look at the film, it's light and delicate and funny, you know, so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but Jeremy, I think, would be the film, even though I never had any of those experiences. I'm not that boy. I don't live that life. I never did. But Jeremy speaks to me on a profound level.
I felt the same way when I saw Lady Bird. I was like, I'm Saoirse Ronan. And obviously.
But there we go. Yeah. I met Saoirse Ronan for the first time on Monday.
Oh, really?
She was in the BFI. I'd done a show, and she was in the BFI, and she was sitting there, and somebody said, "That's Saoirse Ronan." She was talking to somebody I know, and I did the thing, but I kind of went over and I sat down. I studiously didn't, you know, and then I just said, "Oh, hi, Saoirse, I'm Mark." She said, "Oh, hi, nice to meet you." And I said, "Oh, you know Brendan Gunn, the dialect coach." She went, "Oh, yeah, I love Brendan." I said, "Oh, he's a good friend of mine, you know, good friend." I said, "What are you doing? I was literally just trying to go, look, we know similar people because she's so great in everything.
She really is. She's fantastic. This is an interesting one, and I don't know if you have an answer. What is the film you have pretended to like to impress people?
Wow. What is the film I have pretended to like? Well, I will confess that I pretended to like Citizen Kane before I saw it. So it was a huge, it was a huge relief when I actually did see it and I thought it was good.
Yeah, it's quite good, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, yeah, no, no, it's like, and of course, the great joy of it is that it's funnier than you expect. Yeah. And so, you know, you go in thinking, here we go, the greatest movie ever made. Oh God. And then of course it's funny and it's satirical and news on the march and all that stuff, which I really love. I remember I reviewed a film once, the title of it may come back to me. Years later, I think it was called Last Images of the Shipwreck. I think that's what it was called. And I reviewed it for Time Out. And sometime later, Alan Frank, who's a fellow film critic, he was doing some cataloging. He said, I read your review of Last Images of the Shipwreck. And I went, oh, wow. Yeah, it's like 20 years ago. I mean, he said, yeah. He said, that was the best example of somebody pretending to like a film that I have ever read.
Wow.
So evidently, according to, you know, to an outside third party, and I'm more inclined to believe it, evidently I was pretending to like that because it made me seem clever. But he literally said, yeah, it's the best example of somebody pretending to like a film I've ever read.
Well, I think I'd rather a critic pretended to like something than the other way around.
Exactly so.
What is the film you've never seen that you think it's mad you've never seen it?
There's an academic game. You know, Linda, my wife, is a professor of film. Mm-hmm. And there's an academic game, which is a kind of game of a dare game, which is the book that you should have read, that you haven't read, that you've been teaching for 20 years. And it's kind of, you know, it starts at something fairly obscure. And then each person who admits has to crank it closer to what do you mean you've never read Jane Eyre? You know, what do you mean you've never read Emma? You know, it's like that kind of level of thing. But the film that I'm astonished that I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. I've never seen Wild Horse Hank.
That is mad. What's the film? What's the film? You love.
Do you know what that is?
No, what is Wild Horse Hank?
Well, Wild Horse Hank is a Linda Blair film, and I've never seen it, and it's her favourite film that she made.
Then that is really mad.
And I love Linda Blair. I think she's great, and I've never seen it. And the reason I've never seen it is because When I was in my Linda Blair completist period, in which I was trying to get everything she'd ever done, Wild Horse Hank was just not available. But she said it's the one of all her films, it's the one she loves the most. And I interviewed her.
You need to track that down.
I interviewed her and I think I lied. I think I said, oh, yes, I love it too, because I wanted to impress her.
What? I mean, you've got to track that down now. What is the film that you love that you don't expect anyone else to like?
Well, Jeremy is a very good example. I won't. I mean, in fact, like so much so that we have three copies of Jeremy in my house and none of my family have ever seen it.
Really?
And they won't allow them to see it because I couldn't deal with them not liking it. And they think there's a very good chance that they wouldn't like it because I think there's loads of things that were probably deeply wrong with it. And so, you know,
I mean,
Simon won't watch it, and that's the joke, because he thinks the joke is funniest if he doesn't watch it. But it's also entirely possible that he would watch it and just think it's an absolute piece of trash. So I can completely understand. Like, if somebody said to me, should I watch Jeremy? Two parts. One part of my brain would go, yes, it's a lot. It's me. And then the other part of me would go, no, I just really know.
Yeah, because if they don't like Jeremy, they don't like you. Oh, God.
Yeah, and actually, bro, I think that's right. I think there's a part of me that couldn't take that level of judgment, you know?
Yeah, it's too much. Yeah, I don't know how you cope with it. Anyone that doesn't like a film that I love, it hurts my heart. I mean, I can't
answer that. And, well, I always used to make that joke about if you don't like Mary Poppins, we won't be friends. And I didn't mean it as a joke. I meant it as a kind of, you know. Absolutely. The person who I was talking about, the studio head of the people that make, you know, family entertainment, but I thought was a man with a black hole where his soul ought to be. I told him that I cried every time I watched Mary Poppins, and he said, well, you've just made a fool of yourself.
Ah.
But I can't tell you who it was. I can't tell you who it was.
No. Okay. What's the film you would show a lover, that's right, a lover as a test?
I don't have lovers, Brett.
Well, to go back, pre-Linda.
I don't really have lovers then.
A partner. What is the film you would show a partner as a test to see if you should be together?
Mary Poppins.
Great.
I mean, you're sort of tying yourself up in knots here because in a way, I'm kind of, you know, it's like I'm boringly predictable with these answers. But Mary Poppins, I do mean it. I genuinely mean it. It's like, if you don't get Mary Poppins, we aren't going to get on, because so much of, you know, so much of what I believe in is Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
You know,
Mary Poppins is fucking amazing.
It's just a joy. It's about everything that's good in the world. And it's the best. It's the best explanation of the financial crash I've ever seen on film. And the songs are wonderful and it's just transcendent. And it's you know.
I'm sure we talked about it, right? But Save Mr. Banks is the one that made me cry.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely. She says, why did you have to make him so horrible? Yeah, it's just great.
What is the film that made you the most uncomfortable? Is it Martyrs?
Martyrs did make me uncomfortable. Last House on the Left made me feel really, really queasy, but partly because Last House on the Left was kind of a test of that. How much do I actually believe in free speech? Because I was involved in defending it when we were trying to get it uncut through the BBFC. And it's the thing that I had always held was Last House on the Left shouldn't be released uncut because it isn't a salacious piece of nastiness. It should be released uncut because it's an important piece of salacious nastiness, you know. There are some people who say, well, you know, Last House on the Left isn't an exploitation movie. It's actually about the reality of violence. No, it's not. It's an exploitation movie. It was originally called Sex Crime of the Century. You know, it's an exploitation movie. If you think it isn't, you're kidding yourself. In the same way as if you think – people defend films often by disavowing what they are, okay? And the great example for me is Cruising, the William Friedkin film Cruising. People say, well, you know, that film is, you know, it's got this really sort of salacious mix of sex and violence in it. To which the answer is, yes, it has. And if you pretend that that's not part of its appeal, then you're just lying to yourself about the film. I mean, it might be an existential murder mystery and all those other things, but it's also got this incredibly tactile sleaziness to it that actually is very, very cinematic. And I think it's an interesting film, but I partly think it's an interesting film because it's got, you know, all this, you know, stuff going on that's really kind of, you know, it's a film that feels like it's enjoying itself.
Yeah.
You know, in the scenes in which it's apparently meant to be not enjoying itself. Do you know what I mean? It's,
I think it's
a kind of very revealing movie like that. So the times that I've been, I think in the case of Last House, I felt uncomfortable because I was going into bat for it, to make a case for it being released uncut. And so I did have to watch it quite a few times. And every time I watched it, it go, you know, this is really nasty. It's a really nasty film. Even Wes Craven thought the same thing. I mean, he thought it was about something. He thought it was important. And I think it is important because in terms of the evolution of horror, it is about something. But it's also completely nasty. It's got these weird bits of slapstick comedy in it. I said to Craven once, what's that about? He said, well, I felt the audience needed a break. Really? You know, so I think that made me feel very, very uncomfortable. The things that I usually feel most uncomfortable in, though, are films that try to co-opt me into something that I don't believe in. And it most regularly happens in kind of bro humor, which I don't find funny. I just don't find it funny. And I hate the idea, you know, the Entourage thing was, you know, that they said, well, it's every man's dream. It's every boy's dream to have this. It isn't. It wasn't mine. And I'm not alone. I know loads and loads of men who don't have that dream. Not only do I not have that dream, I would literally want to floss my head if that dream ever got into my. And I hate the fact that the film is going, all right, you know, we do really, don't we? And that makes me feel uncomfortable because I feel like just sitting here watching this quietly rather than standing up and being outraged. I once saw a play. It was when I was at Manchester University. It was some kind of bit of agitprop. And I think it was a Brecht piece. I can't remember. But there were these regularly the actors would stand at the front of the stage and say, will you intervene? Will you intervene? And the second time they did it, somebody stood up and said, yep. And they went, oh. And it was like, what the fuck? And it was just like, yeah. There, good for
That's
you.
Great.
Good for you.
That's great. Can we go home now? That's
exactly.
What? Well, it's probably Mary Poppins. What is, if you could show a child one film, what would it be?
Well, Poppins, obviously. And I mean, it's not an if I did. You know, I mean, my daughter and I must have watched Mary Poppins 100 times in a year.
What's the age you start a child on Mary Poppins? What's the youngest?
I think Georgia first saw it when she was about 3.
Okay.
I think that's about right, because it's got songs and an animation, you know, so it's a gateway drug. You know? And we had it on a DVD, but it was a flipper. You had to get up and turn the thing over. So it's exactly the moment when she says, Michael, stop stravaging, you know, because he's got one foot in the gutter and one foot on the thing. And then it would stop. Then you'd have to get up and turn it over, and then there was the tea party on the ceiling. But I don't know, that was kind of like the intermission. So you couldn't fall asleep. You know, you had to be awake to turn the thing over. So we just watched it over and over again. But it's so great because she would see it as a child and I would see it as an adult, and we'd both be enjoying it for completely different reasons. I think the Ghibli films are similar. I think that, you know, you can watch things like Spirited Away. I mean, in fact, I did when my daughter was still quite young. I was given a videotape of Spirited Away because they wanted to do a piece about it on Radio 4. And they'd asked me what I thought about it. This was before the kind of, you know, Ghibli became everything to everyone.
Yeah.
And I sat and watched it with my daughter and she loved it. And I was completely baffled by it. I mean, the narrative was just the bathhouses and the what and the thing and the, pardon, you know, but she just loved it. And I was, you know, and that gave me a way of going, well, it makes sense on some fundamental level that's beyond narrative, you know.
I like that.
And Ponyo is the other great example of that.
Somebody
catches a fish that just turns into a person, but it doesn't really. It's sort of still a fish.
What's the film? I forgot what it's called, but I really, really loved it. And you loved it too. It's quite recent. What's it called? Where the turtle is there's no
dialogue. The red turtle.
And I really loved that film, and it was really beautiful. And I don't think it has any dialogue, right? It's all...
No, it's funnily enough, the bloke goes, hey, when he first arrives on the island, and that's it.
And I was wondering, I have no experience of children seeing it. Did you see that with your children? I wonder how it plays with children.
I have seen it with my children, because I saw it, I loved it, I interviewed... Michael Dutovic, who's the director, he gave me one of the original drawings of the turtle, which I have signed on my wall.
It's such a good film.
You know, and then I just showed it to my family. My family, they were older kids by that point. But, you know, but yeah, it was just like, you have to watch this. It's the best thing ever.
Yeah, it's really something.
Mark Kermode, you have been wonderful. So wonderful, I've decided I'm going to let you live. But
thank you.
I might kill you again one day in the future. So just before I do, there's a will here and you need to leave one DVD for the people behind in case you happen to die again.
Just one DVD for anybody?
Yeah, for your loved ones.
Well, okay. Mm-hmm. I would leave Petite Maman.
Oh.
Because it has...
Get out.
It has, I think, one of the most brilliant depictions of childhood and adulthood. And the bit when the mum says, you know, you're not responsible for my sorrow.
Mm.
It's just... I just think that film is just...
It's amazing.
It's like 82 minutes long and every piece of human life is in there.
Yeah.
You know, I'd say that.
Okay.
I'd say that.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. I also think it's nice you've left for the future where people have no attention spans. You've left a short film. That was very thoughtful. Mark Kermode, I really, really appreciate your time. I've loved doing this again. Thank you.
No, it was fun. Thank you for having me back, bro. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you. If there's anything you want to tell people to listen, look out for, read, or anything, please say now.
Well, you know, I hope that people will listen to the podcast. I hope that they'll find us, you know, on the new podcast. And as you said, not radically different show, really. I mean, it's
wow. You know, I mean, it's like, whoa, it's, but, you know, things are changing.
It's the difference between the People's Popular Front of Judea and the Popular People's Front of Judea. It's that, you know, it's that level of divisiveness. But yeah, no, I would really like it if people found the podcast, and they appear to be doing so, and that's lovely, but I don't ever take it for granted. I do not take it for granted, because Simon and I would like to carry on doing it. We love doing that show. Mm. And we can only carry on doing it if people listen to it. So I know this sounds needy and pleady, but, you know, please download it.
I think they should. I think they will. And I'm sure if they're listening to this, they already do. Mark Kermode, God bless you. Thank you for your time.
God bless.
I will say goodbye and stop the recording. Thank you.
That was a real pleasure. Thank you.
So that was episode 201. Head over to the Patreon at patreon.com/Brett Goldstein for the extra 20 minutes of chat, secrets and video with Mark. Don't forget to get your tickets for the live show at the Hackney Empire July 2nd at hackneyempire.co.uk or plosive.co.uk. So listen, last week I said that I was going to take a break from the podcast. I had so many nice messages from loads and loads of people, and I would like you to know that they all meant an awful lot to me at the moment. I feel very bad about taking this break, but I'm going to take a little break. But there will be more podcasts, I'm sure. So hold on tight. Listen to old ones. If you miss them, come see the live show. I appreciate you all, and I will speak to you soon. Thank you so much to Mark for giving me all his time. Thanks to Scroobius Pip and the Distraction Pieces Network. Thanks to Buddy Peace for producing it. Thanks to Acast for hosting it. Thanks to Adam Richardson for the graphics. Lisa Lydon for the photography. See you very soon. But in the meantime, have a lovely week. And please, now more than ever, be excellent to each other. Thank you. Sometimes I dream of becoming an actor. Have you ever dreamt of becoming an actor? Maureen, what is it you think I do for a living? Never mind, sounds like you need the New York Film Academy. NYFA offers workshops, BFA and MFA degrees and summer camps in filmmaking, acting, journalism and more, online and on campuses across the globe. To make films alongside industry professionals, explore more at nyfa.edu. Thanks, Brett. Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, your Canva presentation looks brilliant.
Thanks, Brett. That's because I used AI-powered Canva presentations. I just described what I wanted, and Canva presentations generated the perfect slides. You can even make a talking presentation for people to watch on their own time. Check this out. Recording. 101 Reasons Why Beaches is the Saddest Film Ever Made by your neighbor Maureen. Is it easy to use? If you can use a computer, you can nail your next work presentation with Canva Presentations at canva.com, designed for work. Oh, thanks, my neighbor Maureen. Yeah, thank you.